actor Stephen Ward.
This seance was recorded on the 14th of October, 1965, medium Leslie French.
Clara, dear.
Oh, good Lord.
Doing one's duty. My goodness me, how one could have a real discussion on that alone, doing one's duty, if one ever really knows what is one's duty.
That is it. You can't.
Sometimes duty is foisted on us.
Yes, that's right.
Anyway, I suppose doing one's duty is doing the best that one possibly can according to one's conscience and one's means.
That's it. That's what counts in life. Doesn't matter about anything else, all the pros and cons and the isms and the all sorts of things.
I think if everyone were to follow the inner awareness or inner consciousness concerning the vast majority of things, the whole world could be changed almost, you might say, overnight. The trouble is that so many people think in such a selfish manner.
The real trouble is that there are so many different religions, and the very religious ones stick to the religions that they are taught.
Yes, but I think there again, talking about religion, I think that fundamentally religion, as it's properly understood, that is, I mean, any religion, seems to me, must be based on do unto thy neighbours you would have done unto yourself sort of thing. Now, I mean, because so few ever think on those lines. Most people think from a selfish point of view. I think they have the wrong interpretation of their religion. It's not necessarily always the religion, the fundamental truth of religion is the fault, but the people's interpretation or lack of it.
One can't get at the truth.
Oh, I don't know. I think you can if you like to really seek for it. But it's like looking for gold, I suppose, digging for gold.
No, but I mean the earthly, did the earth save Bible, for instance, or anything like that? There's so much controversy about
Well, man brings his own material, or you might say material interpretation, which destroys the reality of the spiritual truth that's there. I think that man tries to make his religion fit himself according to his own like.
That's it.
You know, his own liking. I mean, that's the tragedy, I think. But actually, fundamentally, there's nothing radically wrong with most religions when you get down to basic truth, but the truth is so obscured with all sorts of isms and all sorts of, well, creed and dogma and goodness knows what else. Anyway, we don't want to talk about religions.
No.
Actually, I'm trying to sort of work out how best I can sort of describe, I suppose the best thing to call it is awareness or consciousness on different stratas of being or different stratas of vibrational thought.
Oh, yes.
It's terribly complicated, and one hardly knows how to describe it, because what actually it seems to me to be different layers of consciousness. For instance, one may be registering on a certain layer of awareness or consciousness. Now, for instance, when I come to you, I have to leave my own sort of state of consciousness or being, entering into the material or earthly substance, which in itself is to some extent restricting or inhibiting, and I have to strive as best I can when I come and speak to get myself on a conscious level which I feel will be of interest to you. In other words, there are many different conscious layers of thought force which one can tune into, or as it were, become a part of, even if it's only temporary. You see, for instance, on this side of life, I'm living in a state of being on a conscious strata which is applicable to my present rate or condition of progress. But while I'm living this particular aspect, and I use the term aspect of my being or my life, and I have the consciousness of everything around and about me, and therefore I am very much part of it, and it is part of me, at the same time, I can enter a kind of mental strata, which is either below or above. It's much more difficult, as you can imagine, to enter a strata of consciousness above one's own normal. But nevertheless, it is this being able to have what you would term, I suppose, a form of vision, or a form, if you like, of clairvoyance. In other words, it's like not exactly leaving one's body, as you would on Earth. For instance, when you leave the body on Earth and you travel into the astral, and you enter into a condition of life here which is in between, really. The astral is in between the consciousness of Earth and the consciousness of a certain realm or realms of spiritual achievement or attainment. In other words, the astral is a kind of limbo. Well, when I come to you, I often feel, as I enter into the Earth condition, that I am in this sort of intermediary stage of consciousness, but all the time I'm struggling not to think on a material level, and not to think on what I suppose is best to call the astral or limbo condition, as I call it, but to strive to retain and hold on to a mental conception or a mental picture and realization of the condition which is normal to me now, but at the same time trying sometimes to bring through some remembrance of what I experience when I, in my own environment or vibration, enter into this consciousness of and awareness of another dimension or another condition of life. You see, I see this now much more clearly from the point of view that there are many different layers of consciousness. In other words, I can think clearly and distinctly on my own vibration, but at the same time I can, by a form of willpower, if you like, and also aspiration, enter into a conscious state which is only temporary. Sometimes it's not even as clear as one would wish it to be, into something which is something of a world which is not far removed, but at the same time is not yet my natural habitat. In other words, I sort of think to myself, now I've assimilated a great deal from this present conscious state in which I find myself, and I wish to know something of that which is yet to come. I use this term of yet to come, although no doubt it is, as indeed it must be already there, and there of course we enter into this time element. You see, when I come back to you, I think, jumping back and forth, I can't help it. The point is that coming back to you, I'm entering into past time.
Yes.
And yet it is present time to you. When I'm on my side and entering into, or trying to enter into a consciousness above my normal state, I'm entering into a future time. And yet I know that the future time is present time, but to me it's a future time. But it's there, the same as your past, or the earthly past, my past, and the present are all one. In other words, there is no time. I see the timelessness of life, and the consciousness of all life gradually becomes more reasonable, more understandable, more acceptable. I see past ages, past picturization of events appertaining to myself, to you, to other people. I see innumerable reasons which now create sense to me. In other words, I see events of past lives of my own, which, of course, I'd never had the consciousness of when on Earth, but now, to me, are a living reality. And although they are past in time itself, they are, in a sense, ever present. I am beginning now to live, if you can put it in this way, in three dimensions at the same time, or three conscious layers of remembrance or state of being: my present, my past, and my future. Of course, the future, and I use this in a loose sense, is less dim to me, less clear. At times, the past is vivid. Sometimes, in this intermediary stage between the two, which is my real momentary condition, this is clear, of course, and obvious, and normal and natural. It's most intriguing, because it's as if I can split myself into three. Yeah. As if I can be three people.
Oh, yes.
The three consciousnesses, all intermingling.
It's form clairvoyance.
Yes, well, that's what I'm trying to state. Yes. It is, in a sense. You see, I can see myself now, as I talk to you, as I concentrate my thought, in past time and events, I can see myself seated on a white charger, and on this occasion I am obviously going off to some war.
Oh, yes.
I'm going back now to a period of time which must have been somewhere around about the time of the Norman Conquest.
Oh,
and
yes.
I am a soldier or a leader of a vast number of men, mostly on horseback, in this group. And I have on a suit of armor, and I'm told, as I'm seeing this and entering into the consciousness of it, that I was one who landed in England.
In England?
In England, centuries ago.
Yes.
And that I was at the Battle of Hastings.
Oh.
And that I was one of the Norman... I was one of the Norman soldiers in high position, and my name was Beaufort. Simon.
What?
Beaufort.
Oh, yes.
And that I was one of those who took part in this big campaign, and it was really, in a sense, the beginning of, I wouldn't say the beginning of English history, but eventually, I'm told, and as I see this, after this event of warfare, I see myself in a large building, a large castle, overlooking the sea. The castle had been built by me during my lifetime after this battle, and I had assumed a position of great responsibility, and I think I can say, as I look back into this, that I was not what I suppose for my time and age a bad person, but at the same time I was obviously in that incarnation a less evolved person, less knowledgeable person, and I lived, of course, as it was to be expected in such an age and time, a very material existence.
I wonder.
And also that I was, in that period of time, a man of great wealth. As was common in warfare after warfare, one took land and created one's own sort of power for feudal lordship of a large area, and I am very conscious of the fact that this incarnation was the first incarnation I ever had, which led me towards some realization in the latter part of my life of spiritual truth. I had been a man, obviously, who had played a very material part in conquest and had gained a great deal from it. But as I grew older, I became interested in Christianity, I became interested in religion. My conceptions of the religion that I had been taught was not altogether satisfactory to me. I began questing and seeking, but only in the last year or so of my life. And when the time came for me to leave the earth, I was obviously a man who was very dissatisfied when I arrived here, partly due to the fact that I suppose I knew so little if anything about life after death, secondly because I clung very much to material thoughts and ideas in spite of my, in a sense, having an interest in spiritual matters. But then again I realized, looking back, that my interest in spiritual matters sprung, in a sense, through fear. I had lived a life, I suppose, more or less of violence and achievement through violence, and as I knew that I was sick and ill the last year of my life, I was afeared for the future and endeavored to know and to find out, if I could, something that would allay my fears in regards to death without any great satisfaction. But I realized that my fears were purely of a selfish nature, that I was really seeking consolation, seeking help or guidance, or call it what you will, through fear. And therefore, it did not really bring me any great satisfaction. And indeed, I realized very quickly that it was essential and necessary for me to return to Earth, to gain knowledge and experience which only the Earth could bring, and also, to some extent, to make retribution in a different life for much of the things that I had done, which I realized were wrong, And I realize only too well that it's necessary and essential for me to return back to Earth to, in some way, if possible, to live a life utterly different, which would to some extent help to wipe out the past, not that in a sense one can, but at least to make the attempt to live a life that was worthwhile, utterly different and quite unlike that which I'd lived previously. So I returned or was reborn into earthly conditions very soon after.
Yes.
And I was born of a peasant stock, a peasant family, on the very grounds or in the very place where I had died. And in consequence, very few years, indeed, within a matter of 2 years after my death, I had been reborn. And I became, I suppose you call it, a serf. My mother and father were serfs in the estate that I had formed and founded when I had been a conqueror. And in consequence, it was a hard and difficult life. And knowing as I grew older that my life was destined to be one of service as a slave, one dark night I ran away and escaped from the vicinity. I evidently must have told my parents of what I was going to do, and there was consternation because they knew that if I were caught it would mean death. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless I decided to take the risk because I did not want to live a life of serfdom. Mm-hmm. So I left this village, which I suppose you would call it a village. And I, on one night, I took myself away and walked for days and days. Mostly I walked during the night time and slept during the daytime in places where I felt that I wouldn't be discovered, where I felt it would be safe. And fortunately, I was able to get far away from the environment and the place where I was born. And eventually I arrived at what was what you would call a monastery, where the monks had just founded a new order. And I was taken in by them and given refreshment and given help, and they looked after me because I was sick and ill through wandering for many, many days, and they sheltered me. And I stayed with them and worked with them in a menial position for a time. And then they started to give me education. They gave me lessons and taught me to write, taught me to read, and taught me Latin. And eventually, after spending a number of years with them, I became a very good scholar. And I was accepted into their ministry, into their order, and I became a monk. And it was my task, after I'd been there a few years, to go into the various districts to preach the gospel and to talk of the life of Christ and to help the sick and the suffering. We were not a closed order. We were able to speak, and indeed it was a very happy order. And I was given this opportunity, and I had a horse that was presented to me so that I could, on behalf of the group or the brothers, to go to the outlying villages and districts to tend the sick and the suffering, and also to preach the gospel, and also to, where possible, to educate. But, of course, it was difficult in those days. Education was limited, really, more or less, to the nobility and to the monks. And I was attached to a church that was only recently built, which was a small but nevertheless beautiful church, which had been built by another group of brothers, and who also founded a priory. And also I became very active with them because we worked in harmony. In the early days, I think I should make this quite clear. Yes. In the early days of the church, the founding, I suppose you might say, of the church, there was a great deal of realization of truth and a greater understanding of it. And indeed, among many of the groups and the religious orders, there was what you would term forward spiritualism, not as you understand it in the sense today. It was conducted in a manner which really was of a very high order, and the communications that we received were quite a revelation, and they really were at times quite extraordinary. It was not an unusual thing to have what you call, I believe today, transmutations or materializations and so on. But there was in this particular group of which I was a member a very old abbot whose name was Augustine, and he was a very big, fat man, very jolly man, a man who really was in some ways totally unlike what you'd expect such a person to be, but he was a man of great inner awareness and consciousness, and he had a great realization of this truth, and he took a great personal interest in me, and occasionally he and I and several others would have what you would call in modern parlance a session, or would have a seance. Of course, we never obviously think of these things in that light at all. These were moments of communion where we would gather together, waiting for the spirit to enter into us and transport us. And indeed, often in those days, now I visualize and remember these things, it was quite possible to be transported at vast distances and to enter into communication with people still on earth, although we ourselves are still on earth, and we would be able to transmit messages from vast distances of what another order was doing and what was happening and so on. Very much like, I suppose, what the Indian mystics today, you see. These things, what I'm trying to convey here is that these things were known in the early Christian church, and it was considered the correct thing to do for the spirit to descend among you, and we would speak, as it has been said in the Bible, with the tongues of various languages, and we learned languages through communication. We were in communication with the earlier Christians. Sometimes we would have communication with what were commonly called the saints. You see, to us in those days, in the early days of the church, the reality of truth was a tremendous thing. It wasn't something that you talked vaguely about. When you talked about the saints, or you talked about the early church, or you talked about Christ or the prophets and so on, these were not people and things that were appertaining to several centuries ago. These were living realities of the moment. You see, what I'm trying to convey here is that the tragedy with the church today is that it has lost completely touch with the reality of their religion and their background and their faith and their knowledge, which should exist, is no longer there. The early Christian church, the monks that founded the monasteries and did such remarkable things and so on, these invariably, not all, but many, were men of great insight, great realization and spiritual experience. I mean, you know about St. Francis, and you know about the times when he would be wandering in the garden and he would be lost to the world, and he would have these visions, and he would be levitated. And it's perfectly true, because these things did happen with us. And I know that as I become more and more immersed in the Brotherhood, so I became more and more conscious of the realities of the things of the spirit. And as I became a much older man, so I began to understand more what I suppose would be termed the mysteries. These were not mysteries, these were realities. Now, today when people talk about the mysteries, and they talk about the early church, and they talk about the things that happened centuries and centuries ago, these things were realities to us. They were not things that were myths or legends. They were realities of experience, spiritual exaltation. There is so little spiritual exaltation in your world today. But in those days, it was a natural thing among the Brotherhood, among those who dedicated their lives to it, to have mystical experiences.
Yes.
Countries. They were not all Englishmen. In fact, very few of them were Englishmen. In the early days of the monasteries, they were invariably souls who had crossed the seas, who had come from Rome, from Spain, from Galicia, all sorts of other countries, and settled in England. There were many of them, of course, too. This is difficult to explain, and yet it isn't. For instance, when the Norman Conquest, or just after, a lot of these monks came over. You know, when there were great wars, and we're talking about centuries upon centuries ago,
yes.
It was a common thing, although it sounds quite the opposite of what it should be, but nevertheless it was so, that when great armies went out to war, the monks, or groups of monks, or men of religious orders, would go with them. And although one may not admire the fact that they did, but nevertheless they served their purpose, and they did have good intentions quite often. Some were not. I mean, there were frightful monks. There were monks who had dreadful outlook, whose whole basis of starting up orders was of a very material nature. There were exceptions, of course. There were good and bad, as there are in all things. And there were many who sought power. And of course there were many who built themselves great estates and lived like lords themselves. Indeed, that was the tragedy of the early church, really. There were the two factors. There were the good and the bad, even in religion. And there were those who became high in office and had great power, and often wielded that power for ill.
Yes.
Indeed, it's perfectly true. I mean, even in our own order, although we were a happy order, and we were really all of one mind, there were obviously individuals who had not reached the same stage of development, who were not fully in accord, not fully, as it were, in complete agreement. But generally speaking, I was fortunate in finding these monks who were, in a sense, a lowly state. And I think that was the whole point. There was no ambition with them at all. All their ambition was for things of the mind and the spirit and to do good. And indeed, I learned a great deal because there was an apothecary there who had discovered a great deal about herbs and the use of herbs and the different flowers and the different things that could be achieved, and different medicines that could be created and made. And indeed, I learned a certain amount, I discovered, about, that's one reason why I was sent out to heal to the villages, as people who were sick and to care for them. I used to go for days on different journeys, taking various herbs and medicines and so on for the people who were sick and suffering. And of course, in those days, there was great illness, great sickness. Very few people lived to be more than 40. Mm-hmm. It was a very unusual thing to see anyone who'd ever reached the age of 80 or anything like that. Indeed, many, many people never reached the adult stage. Children died like flies. And there was many places, of course, there again, through ignorance, often villages would be built, or at least they would come into being over a period of time, in the most appalling places. They were not even aware of disease, or that it could come, shall we say, from water holes or from rivers, or perhaps it was that, well, because they obviously didn't have the knowledge, but there were many places where it would have been necessary, if they had the knowledge, to have built elsewhere. You see, they didn't always build wisely and well, and sometimes they built in places which lent itself to disease, where there were, for instance, in those days, there was all manner of insects. Of course, these insects still do, to some extent, live now, but the majority of them have been killed off over centuries of time. But there were insects that carried disease, and, of course, cattle was allowed to roam more or less free, and the cattle would drink sometimes this infested water. Okay. And then, of course, it would be carried to the people. But all this is a long story, actually. But I've discovered that I was in this period of time this monk, or I became this monk through a series of events. And I lived to be quite an old man, an exceptional thing for that time. And I died in quite a normal way. And from that life, I suppose really you might say, I had my first experience of spiritual realization. And then again, after having been here for some considerable time, I felt the urge to return to Earth to work in another capacity in a different way. You see, I see back in time now that in some measure it was necessary. I didn't say it was necessary, but certainly I felt it was necessary and I wanted to. And now again, we come to another point about incarnations and reincarnation. In many instances, in fact, I would say almost every instance, incarnation is a matter of choice. And I chose to return, the same as in this last incarnation, which I've just recently left. It was a choice, and I came back. You see, there again, it was as if this thread, if you like to put it like that, of healing the sick was there for centuries in me. I always felt drawn to those who were sad and lonely and those who were sick and poor. And I was given this ability to cure. In my last incarnation, it was of a different kind. It was not through drugs, it was not through medicines and herbs and things. It was through manipulation. And I realize now that this manipulation was not so much manipulation as such. I don't suggest that it didn't play an important part, but it was really what I was doing, without knowing it, of course, was I was giving spiritual healing. I was acting in the capacity of a medium. And that I was being used by cells from this side to give spiritual healing, quite apart from the manipulation, which played some part, of course, obviously. But I knew instinctively, and I never realized it at the time, what was wrong with a person. Sometimes a person would come into my reception room and I'd almost know what was wrong with them, and quite often I did. They didn't have to tell me that they had a pain here or this or that was wrong. I knew. And in some cases, I knew that there was very little hope that I could do much for them. It wasn't that I lacked faith in myself, but I suppose it was that in a subconscious way, without fully understanding it, I knew that I couldn't be of any real help to them. Most cases, I think I can honestly say, I could help, but there were certain cases which I knew couldn't be healed by manipulation, and that it would result eventually in surgery. Now, I always was very much fundamentally against surgery. When I say that, I don't mean to say that I didn't consider sometimes it was absolutely necessary, but where possible, I always wanted to avoid it. I was always suspicious, in the sense of the doctor's knife. And of course, there were patients who came to me who I gave treatment to, but who I knew that although I might be able to help them for a short time, it was something beyond me. Possibly, I might have been able to help them more than I did if I'd had a fuller understanding of the fact that I was being used for spiritual healing. But of course, we have to face the obvious fact that one can do so much and not necessarily any more, and that certain illnesses are obviously deadly, and no matter how much you may alleviate pain or suffering, no matter how much you may be able to prolong the end, eventually, of course, it must come. You see, certain diseases which spring from, obviously, conditions way back in history, not only of the patient, but of perhaps the family. Many things are hereditary. Often this business of hereditary is puzzling. One wonders why the innocent should suffer for the sins of the father, as it were. But there again, it's because we don't understand ourselves. We don't understand how interwoven we all are, how much we are part of each other. we like to think of ourselves quite naturally and in a sense quite rightly as individuals, which of course we are. But nevertheless, it's only when we fully understand that we are all part of each other, we are always the product of other people's thoughts and ideas. We flatter ourselves that we are as we are as individuals, but we are really a composition, a composite personality of untold numbers of people's thoughts and ideas. In the ordinary routine way of life, we are the product of our parents physically. We also become the product of our parents' thoughts and ideas, our education or our lack of it, the friends that we meet, the teachers that teach us, and so on and so on. In a sense, although we are individuals, we are really, in a sense, the product of innumerable minds. And of course, our bodies, which we consider personal and material to ourselves, are in a sense not really so. In a sense, even that is an illusion, and it is subject to all sorts of aches and pains and illness, which are really brought on not always by ourselves, not always by our lack of care. Sometimes, of course, these things do come through lack of care, but we inherit in our bloodstream, in our consciousness, we inherit all sorts of things which are living things, particularly in the material sense when on earth. We are inheriting germs, if you like, and we are inheriting all manner of things which can't be really named. It's an extraordinary thing is that we are as individual as we are, but we must never lose sight of the fact that illness is not something that just happens. It is in a sense ignorance, but nevertheless it's really something which man himself has created through generations of time. I mean, for instance, in this time and age in which you live, cancer seems to be the predominant thing.
Yes.
But this is something which has got into the bloodstream of human life, and it can be traced back to man's thoughts, man's actions through wrong thinking. It can be traced back to man's inhumanity to man, man's attitude towards animal life, the killing of animals, quite often unnecessarily. And you see, everything, people cannot understand this properly, but it's true to say that you cannot possibly escape from your thoughts and your actions. You think perhaps you do something and nobody knows anything about it. You think perhaps you do something and you get away with it. And this, of course, applies to every human being since time began, more or less. But the point is that all these contributory factors, if you do something that is against nature, because nature has rigid laws. Some people might consider that nature has flexible laws. Perhaps it is true in a sense that they're flexible to a point, but it nevertheless, fundamentally, they are rigid. And man has been breaking the laws of nature in an invariable manner, in so many different ways, for such a long time. For instance, it's not natural for man to live in a congested area like a great city, which is full of fumes from motor car exhausts and from factory chimneys and so on and so on. Well, all this is unnatural, but man fundamentally, from a physical point of view, is an animal. Whether one likes this or not is nevertheless perfectly true. You don't get, or very seldom get, and if animals do get diseases, it's invariably what man has brought into the animal kingdom in some shape or form or at some time, which has developed. But in natural surroundings, and I know, of course, in a modern world such as yours, it's practically impossible, but all the illness, the modern illness of man, particularly cancer, springs from the unnatural manner in which man is living. He is eating quite often foods that are poisoned. He is taking upon himself certain responsibilities in work and in business, which are in a sense unnatural, they prey upon his mind and his well-being. His mind has a reaction on the physical body. The physical body reacts to that. The bloodstream becomes contaminated in so many different forms and different ways. If a man wants to be fit, well and healthy, quite apart from him thinking on the right lines, he must get back and live with nature under natural conditions, eating nature's natural foods. Life is poisonous. As man advances scientifically, and in some senses he advances in the right direction, at the same time he is all the time advancing in one sense rightly and in one sense wrongly. If he could advance in a natural way, as nature intended, he would find that all the sickness and the illness that has been brought about through, particularly this last 100 years, he would then find that he would be a fit man and a well man. I know, of course, what I say in a sense must seem and probably is impractical for most people. The fight, the strife, the stress, and so on of modern life is unavoidable for most. But I see, as we live back, and I'm going back again into time, when we lived a simple life, when we lived in a community, and we lived upon nature's source of supply, and we began to understand nature and use nature in a sensible manner, because nature gives freely and doesn't expect very much, if anything, in return, except in that you respect it. That today modern life is full of incongruous habits, incongruous ideas. Man is becoming more and more separated from natural foods, natural surroundings, natural conditions. Man is constantly investigating scientifically, so-called, and in some cases it is scientific, different products, different ways of labor-saving and time-saving, and putting into food certain chemicals that he thinks will do this or that good. But these things may, in some instances, not all, do some good. But you do find that where they do good in some cases, they set up troubles and complexities in others. Man is not living as he should live, in a natural way. And the stress of life is beginning to tell. Man is living in fear. He's living in fear through various sources, various reasons. I mean, he's all the time uncertain of the morrow, uncertain of what may come to pass through atomic power. Now, again, atomic power, properly understood, which, of course, they don't really understand properly yet, obviously, they're still experimenting, go on experimenting, but that could be harmless for man's good. For everything, you see, that is discovered, there is a good cause and there's a bad one. Invariably man uses it for bad rather than for good. But the point is, there's so much that is yet to be discovered. But knowing man, we know more or less with certainty that whatever he discovers, he will invariably put it to bad use rather than to good. And it is a tragedy, too, to us, when we see the way in which nature is tampered with, nature is misused.
Yes.
And it causes us great concern, because we see, for instance, the animal kingdom. We see the tragedy of the animals. Some animals are becoming extinct. Man is hunting them unnecessarily, killing them quite often without thought, without any sort of real purpose. And there is no need for it, because nature always finds its own way. It will always find for itself its own outlet. If, for instance, an animal or a breed of animals became too vast, then nature itself would devise a method where they would not be allowed to become too many. Mm. This may in itself perhaps seem a strange thing to say, because animals, I know this will not necessarily be accepted or understood in certain quarters if it were listened to, but animals do not have the vast majority of the diseases that man suffers from. invariably, if an animal is sick or ill, it's something which has been brought into being by man himself. Some poisonous matter that they've picked up, or perhaps has been laid unconsciously and the animals have suffered from it. But the point is that the animal kingdom has, in some ways, a much more remarkable way of life, even than man himself. It's an extraordinary thing, but the animal kingdom has instinct, which man has lost, I suppose. You see, man still has instinct, obviously, for self-preservation, for instance, but the point is this, that man has lost, as he has become more sophisticated and more so-called progressed, has lost the natural being able to become aware. He's lost the instinct for much that was essential and necessary to him. People may argue and say, oh yes, well of course when man was very primitive, it was very necessary for him to have these strongly defined instincts. But it applies just as much to modern man as the ancient man. In the progress, so-called, of man, the progress of man, he has lost the natural instincts. You know, in the ancient times, if a man was sick, he knew within himself, to some extent, I don't say in every case, or that it was always infallible, but he knew certain things that he should do, or perhaps even certain things that he should eat. Whereas today, man doesn't give nature a chance to assert itself, to take care of itself. Man doesn't give nature a chance to cure the body. Immediately, man rushes to drugs,
yes,
artificialities, which set up toxins and all sorts of poisons in the body. And though they may alleviate or relieve temporarily some pain or ache or whatever it may be, invariably do far more harm than good. And another illness, a sidetrack illness, develops. Indeed, I would go as far as to say that many of the so-called modern illnesses are the byproducts of drugs taken perhaps 50 years, 25 years ago, in some cases and even more, of our parents. You see, the children take into their lives, their new life, from the physical, in the bloodstream, poisons and germs from the parents. And all these things, as the body grows, begin to become very active. Sometimes they don't become very active until perhaps the child has reached adult stage or middle age. But eventually you get these germs of war. There's warfare going on all the time in the human body. And I'm not suggesting that this didn't to some extent apply in the early centuries or early time of man. No doubt it did, but not to the extent that it does. You see, the rhythm of life has been destroyed in man. In the early centuries of time, in man's early history, there was a rhythm, and I can only use this term rhythm, it's the only way I can explain it, but there was rhythm in man's body, there was a rhythm in his life. He lived in a rhythmic world of nature which was in harmony with the elements. In other words, in the early stages of man's history, there was a form of perfection. I use the term form of perfection because I assume there's nothing perfect. But nevertheless, there was a form of perfection as far as human life was concerned. And in consequence, man lived a more perfect being from the point of view of nature. Man now lives a completely and absolutely unnatural existence. Now, I'm not saying by this that man has got to revert back to the natural state and go about naked, and that he's got to get away from cities and so on, because I realize that such a thing now is impossible. But what I do suggest is, and this is something I discuss with many people here, that if man could get back as far as it's possible to some form of natural life and natural food, he would gradually begin to benefit from it, and certain illnesses, which are now very prevalent, will gradually diminish, and no doubt, possibly with time, disappear. Cancer is the body out of rhythm, and it is a disease that has been brought about by modern way of life and modern society, Drugs have been no help at all. In fact, I think the drugs have contributed largely towards it and its development. And I can tell you one other thing,
yes,
that no success for finding a cure for cancer can ever come or will ever come through experiments on the animal kingdom. Mm-hmm. For if you use these methods, it is against nature, and nature will rebel. You cannot put into your body something that is unnatural and something that is taken from another less significant so-called creature who suffered unnecessarily and unduly at the hands of man. In other words, there is only one way to cure humanity, whether the ills be of the mind or of the body, and that is to live to nature. Live to the mind and to the spirit on the highest possible level that you can conceive. In other words, this modern age is the product of evil thought and evil living. I use the term evil because in a sense it does apply. I know evil is sometimes a misused word because often evil is applied to things that are not evil at all. But I'm talking about the things which obviously are artificial. For evil is artificial, it is against nature, it is against the truth, it is against the reality of spirit and of mind. Anything that is against these things which are fundamental and which are essentially of the highest aspect of man are evil. In other words, good is that which is of God, for which men aspire, to which they must eventually become. In other words, the goodness in man is the natural rhythm in man, the natural realization of man, of his oneness with the divine and the power of the spirit within him to accomplish and to overcome and to become truly, fully aware and fully conscious of his destiny. Truth is the basis of all life. If man will follow truth in all things, he will gradually lose the individual I'm talking about rather than collectively, although it could be collective if everyone endeavored to follow it, but the individual man will find release from these things which cause so much tragedy and so much concern, whether they are of the mind and the body and of the spirit, if he will follow truth, seek truth, aspire to truth, and within himself become part of truth. In other words, all these things, and I have found this through generations now, I realize, of time and experience in different lives and incarnations, and above all through my knowledge and experience here, of the vision that I've had already, of the experience I've had of the past, I know that the fundamental truth is the only thing that matters. All else is fallacy, all else is illness, either of the mind or of the body. Seek truth in all things, and the rest will surely be added unto you. As has been said, you know, I've spoken to so many here, people of all denominations that once were of earth, and they all understand and realize now that it is only the seeking after truth in the highest sense, with freedom of thought, freedom of mind, freedom of expression, getting closer and closer to the realities of nature and to the things of the spirit. These are the only things that matter. The isms and the religions and the creeds and the dogmas and all the fallacies and the illnesses of the mind and the body, these are the things that hold man down. These are the things that create the illness of the mind and of the body. There is sickness of mind through misunderstood and misapplied religious thought. There is sickness of the body and of the mind through the things that one eats and the things that one does. There's the breaking away from natural law. Until you live with natural and spiritual law, you cannot truly be a true individual. You cannot truly become, as it were, in a sense, I suppose, but in a religious term, a son of God. It's all very difficult to explain, but this I do know, that all that transpires in the world that is bad, that causes grave concern, whether it be of sickness of the body or of the mind, or lack of knowledge in a religious sense or spiritual sense, is because of man himself. It's quite obvious to me as I gain more and more experience that man himself creates for himself. Nothing more, nothing less. No one else is responsible but man himself. But until man learns to live with God and the expression of life that is found in nature, he cannot be mentally or physically well. There's so much I can't put into words. I want so much to say so much, but I know I can't hope to do much yet, but eventually, yes.
Thank you very, very much, Stephen.
Anyway, we must have another natter next week, and all being well, because there's so much I want to tell you, so much about my past, and the past as it affects other people that I am fond of, people that are associated with me. I want to talk about various aspects of life as I've now found it and what I feel is waiting, that I've had glimpses of. In other words, it's the past, the present and the future, which in a sense I suppose really are all one, but nevertheless there's so much I've got to convey that I can only do it bit by bit. And as I do it, of course, I realise only too well that in a sense I must obviously get more and more away from my old self, but that doesn't matter, that's what I want to do. Anyway, that's my job.
Well, you have helped me a big deal.
Anyway, all I want you to know is that while we've been sitting, and I've been talking to you, of course I've not been alone by any means, there's been a tremendous power here, tremendous help.
Tonight, yes.
Yes, and I know that you'll feel the benefit from it, both of you. Anyway, I must go, and I'll come next week, I must go.
Bye-bye,
and God bless Rosie, and all the best, don't worry. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.